and welcome to the AVOD, where I, Count Vargelon,
and I, the Dive Mistress,
take you on a journey through some of the most pressing issues in genre fiction today. And today we have one hell of a special show with a couple of fun new features. First off, we're going to do some viewer mail. Then, a little later in the show, our correspondent Merman is going to be taking us on a journey through the greatest year in cinema history, 1989. Just for the record, our correspondent Merman is also here in the studio acting as our producer, but he won't be saying anything or doing anything. In addition to that, we've got some neat new John Carpenter news, a back and forth about the idea of a PG-13 horror film, and the Dive Mistress and Count Vargelon's special preview of the year in film. So, Dive Mistress, start us off.
Okay, well, we have our first bit of viewer mail, and this comes from Tara. And she writes, "The reason I'm dropping you this line has to do with the last AVOD. You talked about how any movie that ends with everything being a dream invariably sucks. For the most part, I agree with you, but I think there is one exception, Jacob's Ladder. It's the one movie that at the end turns out to be a dream and doesn't suck." So, Count, anything you want to say?
Okay. First off, Tara, thanks for your mail. We always like hearing from our fan. Although, since this is the first time that has actually happened, I don't know if we're going to continue liking it. So, always might not be the best word to use. Let's just say, in this instance, we have enjoyed hearing from our fan. As for your comment, yes, you're right. Every rule does have an exception, and Jacob's Ladder is, like, unquestionably a good film, where at the end it turns out to have all been a dream. I guess my only comment on that situation would be that because it's set entirely within the dream world, you know, it's not like there's the world where he's outside of the dream and then the dream world. So, like, it doesn't matter because the film is basically set...
It's not bookended in any
way. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Because the film is essentially set entirely within his dream... it's less of a cheat because it's all about the experience that he goes through. But I'm not trying to devalue your point. You're completely right. It is an entirely dream movie that is high quality. Oh,
okay. I personally have never seen Jacob's Ladder. So,
Okay.
Unfortunately, I can't really speak.
Oh, well.
But everyone I talk to who's seen it tells me it's amazing.
Our producer, Merman, has just put up a sign. He says he wants to point out that another film where it's a dream that does not suck is The Wizard of Oz, which is an interesting point, because I've always thought the fact that it's a dream at the end of Wizard of Oz does incredibly suck. Sorry.
Okay,
he has now amended the note to announce that The Wizard of Oz does in fact suck. So, we can forget that point. And let's not forget that The Wizard of Oz was not originally a dream at the end. In the book, Oz is a real place, and it's only because the studio executives were nervous about putting out the idea of there being a communist utopia that it all had to be a dream.
Really?
That is completely true. Look it up. Wizard of Oz, because the Munchkins lived as communists, was banned in libraries throughout America right until the 60s.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. And I went to an exhibit on banned books, and that wasn't in there.
I only know this because Merman told me one time. So there you go.
Oh.
Apparently, there's all sorts of political subtext. Apparently, I got
to
see that again. Apparently, there's all sorts of political subtext in The Wizard of Oz that we don't get today because it was about the time he was writing it.
Okay.
So you would need a better film historian than I to be able to tell you what it all meant.
Okay.
So, again, thank you for the mail. Please, if you have any more questions or comments, keep sending them in to theavod@gmail.com. Now, next up, I read a little piece of news on the internet the other day that I wanted to share with everybody because it's completely appropriate after our discussion of John Carpenter's The Thing last week. So have you heard about this?
Okay, lay it on me. No, I don't read the news.
Okay. Well, it comes from the really questionably accurate WENN News, the something entertainment news network, I guess, that the Internet Movie Database runs.
The W is probably for weekly.
What's that?
The W?
Oh, yeah, actually, no, but it's probably a daily service, so I really don't think so. Anyway, on the 30th of January, they put the following piece of news out. Fans of director John Carpenter's horror movie The Thing are in for a treat. Plans are afoot for a prequel. Studio bosses at Universal have revealed they are working on a new movie with screenwriter Ronald D. Moore, the man behind the relaunch of the sci-fi series Battlestar Galactica, to explain how the shape-shifting alien came to be discovered. So,
oh, no.
Yeah, I'd like to point out that they're completely misjudging what fans of Carpenter's movie would consider good news. Because
that's terrible news.
Yes, it really is. Because good news would be, you know, everyone can watch the movie free forever because it's the best horror movie ever made. Like, good news
that would
is
be very good news.
Because, I mean, what could this movie... this movie, like, it's not a new thing. The idea that it's going forward is a new thing, but they've been trying to do this for, like, 3 or 4 years. And the idea has been, hey, let's do a prequel where we tell the story of the Norwegian guys at their camp who originally found the spaceship and accidentally blew it up and then all got killed by the Thing. But notice how the last part I did when I was synopsizing the plot was they all got killed by the Thing? Like, this is the worst kind of prequel. Like, we already know exactly what happened to all of those characters.
Yeah.
This is a film This is a film that could exist for one purpose. And when I tell you the purpose for which it could exist, feel free to scream in existential horror, okay? Here's the reason it could exist.
All right, I'm ready.
So that someone will have an excuse to render the Thing effects in CGI.
There are really no words.
Did I just make you profoundly depressed?
Not so much depressed as maybe I've lost all my hope and faith in humanity.
So you're not depressed, you're just spiritually void.
Yes.
It might be worse.
Yes. The plan for this Thing prequel has destroyed my soul.
I gotta say, Merman has just pointed out, and I think he's right, that is probably worse than depression. So, good work, Ronald D. Moore and the bosses at Universal. You've destroyed the dive mistress's soul. Okay.
Sad,
in the most awkward segue in history, I'm going to segue into our next topic. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready. Go.
And you know what else they're going to do with this The Thing remake? They're going to make it PG-13!
There is no such thing as a PG-13 horror movie.
You know, I know in segments like this we're supposed to debate things, but I agree with you 100%. I could argue with you. I wish I could come up with an argument for a PG-13 horror movie. Maybe Tara will do it for us, because I can't come up with one.
No, it can't be done. Every single one I've seen has sucked. Including Cry Wolf, and that had Bon Jovi in it.
Including what?
Cry Wolf.
Cry Wolf. Which one? Oh, yeah, we saw Cry Wolf. Yeah. That was terrible, and it had Bon Jovi in it.
That's what I said.
Oh, right. Yeah, our producer just pointed out a little movie called Fangs, which was the direct-to-video ripoff of Bats. And Fangs answered the question, what if you had made a Killer Bat movie? What if you had taken a script for an episode of Family Matters and added Killer Bats to it?
I never asked that question.
No, no one had ever asked that question. It was written by a Family Matters writer, and he apparently is only able to depict interpersonal relationships as they appear on sitcoms. So in his bloody movie about Corbin Burnson making bats attack people for real estate purposes, it was just constantly characters dropping things and having pratfalls, and there was a character named Logan who was the dumb guy, and everyone always shrugs and rolls their eyes and says, Logan! I really advise everyone see the movie Fangs. Although it was PG and god awful, just a terrible PG-13 horror movie.
Well, you recently saw another PG-13 horror movie.
I talked about it
a couple weeks ago, The Unborn.
That is correct. And
so can you maybe explain your reasoning behind why you went to see this movie, knowing it was PG-13?
Okay.
Knowing that it wasn't going to be any good.
I have the greatest excuse at all for seeing the film The Unborn. And that is Gary Oldman was in it. So I get a bit of a pass for that, I think. But B, it is because someone else, a friend of mine, wanted to go and see a movie and invited me along. And if that happens, I have no choice but to go. I will literally go and see any movie in a theater if someone asks me to go and see that movie with them. I have no shame. I have no judgment. Nothing. Like, I can know it's going to be terrible.
I'm gonna test that theory.
You're going to test that theory? Okay.
And you're still going to spend money on it.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, it's... Okay, I will put an addendum. Only for a matinee on a weekday will I do that. Because matinees for weekdays are still relatively cheap. So there you go. I have edge of an excuse. No, but I mean, yeah, going in, I knew it was going to be awful. I knew it was going to be the worst they could do is a little bit of blood here and maybe some, you know, bugs falling out of people's mouths or something like that. But I knew there wouldn't be any, you know, real violence or real scares because there never is. I mean, and in my text piece on the castle, about Unborn, I pointed out that it was like ridiculous jump scares because that's all you ever get in a PG-13 horror movie.
Yeah. Well, I don't really understand. Well, okay, I do understand the need or the perceived need to make a PG-13 horror movie because it's an attempt to sort of to reach a wider audience. But I think you're doing yourself a disservice because if you take what could potentially be a really scary R-rated film and you water it down to PG-13, you're actually alienating a huge audience, a huge potential audience for your movie because a lot of people won't go and see a movie because it's PG-13.
Yeah, I think you're right. Essentially, no one above the age of 17, and, you know, maybe I'm even underestimating 17-year-olds here, maybe no one above the age of 15 would ever go and see the movie Prom Night.
I kind of wanted to see that.
What is wrong with your brain? That didn't have Gary Oldman in it.
I know.
Although both of them featured Stringer Bell from The Wire.
Although, okay, here's the thing. I heard about the remake of Prom Night, and I thought, oh, you know, okay, I'll probably see that. And then I found out it was PG-13, and I was significantly less interested in going to see it, even though I still kind of wanted to because, you know, I like to see originals and remakes.
Of course. We should do a show about that.
Watch for that upcoming project.
But, yeah.
Yeah. But I still just, I've been burned so many times at the goddamn PG-13. I think what was Captive was the other one I saw about celebrity who's kidnapped by some psychopath who locks her in a box or cage and then has her dress up in different outfits and...
Oh, right. I remember that. I didn't come anywhere near seeing that.
So terrible. And apparently, there was this whole big deal about it because its ad campaign was so extreme that it was pulled from TV.
Oh, yeah, the one with the billboard ads that had women being brutally murdered on them. I remember that.
Yeah, that doesn't happen. Well, okay, you get the murder set pieces. You get the aftermath of the brutal murder, but you don't get the murder.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah. And the thing is,
I guess they're pushing the envelope with that one.
No, but you're right. You're absolutely right. I mean, I feel in largely the same way about, you know, most action films. I was kind of offended by that PG-13, Die Hard movie. Because that just seemed wrong to me. Although, to be fair, I just saw Taken, or as I call it, Liam Neeson Pimp Killer. And that thing was PG-13. And I didn't mind at all. Although, frankly, it was one of those
ad. It looks like it shouldn't be.
Oh, no, but if you watch the film,
and you find out that it is,
you honestly are going to ask, how did this get a PG-13? Because he tortures people by electrocuting them, and he shoots, like, 5 different people in the face, like... That, and I'll give PG-13 this. There are some films that push what a PG-13 is. Like, they don't want to alienate their market. They know they need the PG-13. But they really release an R-rated movie and have the studio bribe the MPAA to call it PG-13. And I really think Taken is one of those. Because it's kind of a nasty movie, really. And that's a lot of why I liked it.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe I'll give that one... I'll give that one a chance.
It had a fun, nasty brutality that was really missing from the Transporter movies, which are very light. And I gotta say, and
I like the Transporter.
You'll get some nasty. I'm complaining. I'm just saying they're light, you know. Whereas you'll get other nasty, brutal films like your Cranks and whatnot. But this one is not for people who are hopped up on energy drinks. It's a real movie.
You've really got this Jason Statham thing going right now.
I'm talking a lot about Jason Statham today, and I didn't mean to, and I promised you I wouldn't talk about Death Race. So I'm not going to continue talking about Jason Statham. But the thing is, because Jason Statham is the only viable action star today, it's hard to talk about action movies and their various ratings without talking about him because he's run the gamut from a Transporter to a Crank.
I mean, Vin Diesel's a big action star.
Is Vin Diesel a big action star? Because what was the last movie
he
made?
He is for me.
I know he is for you.
Babylon AD.
Seriously, he was in Babylon AD, a film no one saw.
It doesn't mean the film doesn't exist.
No, but I'm saying the fact that no one saw it means he's not a viable action star. At least people go to see Jason Statham's movies. Although I will give him this. And I will give him this, right? He is making a sequel to The Fast and the Furious. He is the star of Fast and the Furious 4. Fast and Furious. And I assume that will be action-packed. But it's like that... He didn't make an action movie for 4 years after Chronicles of Riddick.
He must have.
No. Chronicles of Riddick. Next was The Pacifier, which cannot be called an action movie. His attempt at drama in Find Me Guilty. An uncredited cameo in The Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift. And then Babylon AD. So that was a 4-year gap.
When was Triple X?
2002, way before Riddick. Now, I want to point out that in that same period of time, 2004 to 2008, Jason Statham made 7 action movies. Okay. In the time that Vin Diesel was making no action movies, Jason Statham made 7 successful action movies and appeared in The Bank Job, which had action in it, and appeared in The Name of the King, A Dungeon Siege Tale, which is just so bad I wanted to mention it.
No, we're not going to talk about any Uwe Boll movie.
Okay, I don't know how this became a conversation about Jason Statham, but maybe we should take a step back.
I don't mind. I love Jason Statham. I'll talk about him.
Maybe we should take a step back and look at the point we were trying to make, which is, you know, the lack of decent horror. And I think, and I mean, maybe this is just the despair I feel, because I know the despair you feel, because you have expressed it so eloquently with your The Thing statement. But yeah. The despair I feel is when I, as a fan of horror and as a fan of R-rated horror, I realize that, like, I want to see R-rated horror, but the only people out there pushing R-rated horror are people I hate. And by people I hate, I mean Rob Zombie.
You mean the French.
No, French is all unrated horror because it doesn't get a theatrical release. I mean Rob Zombie. I hate Rob Zombie. I hate him.
Yeah,
I hate his music. I hate his movies. I hate how impressed he is with himself. There's nothing he's ever done.
A little too far with that one. I like his music.
I read his script for his version of The Crow 3, and you may have thought that nothing could have been worse than The Crow Salvation. This was worse than The Crow Salvation.
Wow. I didn't even see Crow Salvation.
Don't.
Okay. I won't.
Yeah. In fact, honestly, viewers, please, if you could come up with a PG-13 horror movie that's any good, I would be happy to hear it, because I would love to be proven wrong on this one, because there are so many PG-13 horror movies out there, and they're all god-awful. So please, find me something.
I suppose on the upside, it kind of makes us all hunger for a really good R-rated horror movie. And so when one comes along, we all just flock to the theaters. So maybe it's some kind of conspiracy.
Maybe.
I don't know
about
that.
You know what? You know what really
however,
do you know what really ticks me off about it?
What?
That it has caused internet film critics to rally around French splatter porn, because they're so desperate for gore in their horror movies, they'll be like, oh, it has gore in it, it must be a classic. So you get all of these horrible human beings, my opinion of them has fallen quite a bit since I wrote this review last year, telling people to watch the movie Inside just because there's gore in it. You know what, that doesn't make it a good movie. Okay, just like it's not
no Re My Bloody Valentine 3D.
Henry. Oh, by the way, Merman and I are going to see that tomorrow. So, yeah, we are very psyched to see that bad boy.
Mm-hmm.
I may offer my brief capsule comments at the beginning of the Jason podcast next week, but we'll see. Anyway, but yeah, I mean.
But yes, gore does not equal good.
No, gore does not equal good. And I'm not saying the absence of gore equals bad, because, I mean, you could obviously, I guess it's possible to make, you know, a PG-13 rated horror movie that could happen. I mean, we say there's no such thing as PG-13 rated horror, but I think the problem is not that it doesn't have gore, not that it doesn't have blood, and not that it isn't legitimately scary. Although, okay, the fact that it's not legitimately scary is part of the problem. I think the fact is, and tell me what you think of this theory, is that no one ever sets out to make a PG-13 horror movie. A PG-13 horror movie happens when compromises are forced on filmmakers by marketing executives. So the PG-13 always means, in every respect, this is a compromised film. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'll agree to that. It's just, it's weird, because it just seems like the PG-13 horror movie, not all PG-13 horror
movies. No, I'm only talking about horror movies.
Horror movie
sorry.
In particular.
Yeah.
No, I know that.
Okay.
It's caught in between, like, the kids' film and then the grown-up film. And you can have really great, terrifying children's movies. They don't make them anymore, but they used to.
Oh, God, did they ever.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got really great, terrifying movies for grown-ups.
Yep.
So it's, you're sort of stuck in the middle where you want to make a really great, terrifying movie for a teenager, but you can't because you just you can't.
No, you're absolutely
no,
right.
No, I will. I'll agree with your statement, though. It's sort of this, it's this enforced middle ground.
Yeah, it's this enforced middle ground that, like, acts as a great big badge on the front of the film that says, the studio created this movie.
I'm not any good. Yeah. Don't rent me. Yeah.
You know, that's why, you know, that's why all horror movies in video stores are unrated.
Yeah. Like, nobody wants to see... Well, everyone wants to see what got cut out.
Exactly. Everyone wants to see all the R-rated stuff that got cut out for the PG-13 theatrical release. It's ridiculous. And
yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to get into a thing about...
But again,
that
leads into my conspiracy theory.
Oh, your conspiracy theory,
in that
please.
They go to make an R movie, and then they cut it down to PG-13. You know, on the one hand, to generate a larger audience for the R movie when they ever get around to making that. And on the other hand, of increasing their video sales when the movie comes out on DVD, because then you get all these people flocking to the video store to rent the unrated version.
Oh, right. So it's a movie they've already seen once, but they'll watch it again. They might not have watched Prom Night a second time if it hadn't had this unrated footage.
Exactly.
Although now I'm picturing someone actually watching Prom Night twice, and oh my god. Yeah, when you get around to seeing that movie, you'll understand my shock at that concept.
You have some serious masochistic tendencies, you want to watch that movie twice.
I would say that would be a description, yes. Okay. So now, on the AVOD, we have an extremely special feature. Our, I guess, film history correspondent is what you'd call him. Merman is going to come in and introduce us to his new feature, in which he takes us through the greatest year in the history of cinema, 1989. Please take it away, Merman.
Hi, boys and girls. I'm the Merman. As you know, this year in the Gregorian calendar is, of course, 2009. This marks the 20th anniversary for what is perhaps the seminal year in cinema history. For those of you who are, like myself, terrible at even basic math, the year I'm referring to is 1989, a year in which Driving Miss Daisy grabbed the coveted Best Picture Oscar. Close on its heels were Oliver Stone's Born on the 4th of July, The Dead Poets Society, Kevin Costner's Field of Dreams, and My Left Foot. I will not be addressing the content of any of these films, since, surprisingly, I've seen none of them. I've heard from a number of separate sources that Miss Daisy has an Uncle Tom level of over 9,000, but I don't really care, because I love Morgan Freeman. I know nothing about 4th of July, but if I know my Oliver Stone flicks, I assume it's filled with references to the tragedies of Euripides by way of Nietzsche, with a slutty witch lady thrown in for good measure. In other words, the laughs don't stop. Most of what I know about dead poets comes from an episode of Full House that's a sort of tribute featuring Uncle Jesse being forced to memorize the poem Captain, My Captain. Field of Dreams holds an especially sacred place in the halls of films I've not seen, since a VHS copy of it has been on loan to me for over 15 years. And to this day, I haven't even put it in the machine. I have now built a paranoid ritualistic mythology around the whole affair, in which I've come to believe that if I ever do watch it, I will cry tears of wonderment at its incomprehensible beauty, tears that will burn my skin like acid as my body crumbles to wind-swept ash, with me wearing a smile all the way. Sometime later, my loved ones will enter the room, look wistfully at the pile of cinders that was once me, and at that exact moment, the movie will say, "If you build it, they will come." Understanding that this is a sign that I wanted it this way, they will then happily reach for a broom and dustpan. Since I wasted all my A material on that last one, I don't really have anything funny or clever to say about My Left Foot, other than that I haven't seen it either. Regardless, none of these movies will be discussed in my poorly planned upcoming series of reviews of what I consider some of the greatest cinematic gems ever produced. I invite you to join me in 2009 as I revisit such groundbreaking movies as Karate Kid 3, which, though often overlooked, remains the greatest in the four-part series, due largely to Thomas Ian Griffin's performance as Terry Silver, a villain easily rivaling Shakespeare's Iago in his Machiavellian machinations. We will also relive the musical cult hit Teen Witch, starring Karate Kid 3's female lead, Robin Lively. We will venture into the obscure underbelly of the direct-to-video market with the mind-boggling mystery that is Creating Rem Lazar, a sing-along children's film decades ahead of The Matrix and Truman Show in terms of Gnostic semiotics. Other reviews will include such masterworks as The Wizard, the greatest movie-length video game commercial of all time, and Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, a film so good it reminds us why we let the King of Pop get away with touching our kids. Allegedly. Finally, we will review the crown jewel in the collection, a movie that is, objectively speaking, the greatest work ever to grace the big screen. What is it? You'll have to join the literally ones of people listening to find out in this, the China anniversary of 1989, the greatest year in film history. That's right, apparently 20 years is a China anniversary. I was hoping for something cool like silver or gold, but you take what you can get, I guess.
No, I think I'm going to disagree with you on that point.
You can say that again, Dive Mistress.
Okay, sure. Next on the list of important things to discuss, we have the year in review that hasn't happened yet.
So a year in preview, if you will.
I'm going to stick with what I just said. So in this new feature, we are looking ahead to movies that are going to come out later this year, 2009. We're going solely on the title of the film. And we're just going to give you a little hint or a little taste of what to expect from each one. And Count, why don't you give us a... why don't you start us off?
Okay, Dive Mistress, I'm happy to. I'm going to start with a little movie coming later this year called The Chrome Angels. It's the sequel to The Stone Angel. But this time around, Hagar Shipley's corpse is dug up, cloned, and then the clones are turned into cyborg-killing machines as part of a mad scientist's attempt to take over Manitoba. There's only one man who can stop them. Brig Gingham, military orthodontist.
That sounds incredible. I love robot movies.
I know. And it's a robot movie based on a Margaret Lawrence novel.
Looking forward to it. I've only ever seen one other film set in Manitoba.
Really? What was that?
Spliced.
I have not seen that.
I don't know if it's actually set in Manitoba, but it was filmed in Manitoba.
Well, I've seen plenty of movies filmed in Manitoba. That doesn't count.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. What's next?
Next we have Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li. And this, I think, is a widely or hugely anticipated film. But due to confusion on the part of the producer, Street Fighter, The Legend of Chun-Li brings together Ryu and Bloodsport's Chun-Li, who battle for ultimate Street Fighter supremacy. Jean-Claude Van Damme returns as Guile, and Antonio Banderas takes on the role of Bison, filling in for the late Raul Julia. And Guile, who now retired from street fighting, grudgingly takes Ryu under his wing and trains him to fight in the upcoming Street Fighter tournament. Also fighting in the tourney is Chun-Li, Guile's former protege, and now renegade underground bare-fisted champion. Fighting montage follows a flashback, followed by a training montage, followed by another fighting montage, and viewers should watch for Sonny Chiba's cameo as a Border Patrol guard.
I wish I could say that I, you know, could wait for that, but I can't. I can't wait for that.
No. It's going to be amazing.
Okay. Next up on my list is a little movie called Transformers 2, Revenge of the Fallen. As we're all aware, the Fallen in the title refer to the angels of the Lord who stood with Lucifer against the armies of God and were cast down to hell as punishment. This punishment consisted mainly of being forced to watch the film Transformers over and over again. And now those Fallen want to get their revenge by bringing Hellfire to Earth and killing the Transformers once and for all. And if they can get Michael Bay while they're there, all the better. I know. We did not see that coming.
I wasn't a huge fan of Transformers, I gotta say. But then I'm looking forward to the sequel.
Okay.
Also out later this year is Eden Log. Now, the Eden Log is a mythical stave, which is a wooden staff, carved from driftwood found on the shores of Avalon. Whoever wields the Eden Log controls the fairies, and the last person to do so is Meg, the Dark Queen, who sought to usurp King Arthur's throne. Merlin captured the Eden Log and broke it in two, throwing one half to the east wind and the other to the west. When Ban Dianu finds a broken wooden staff in his grandfather's shop, he asks the old man where the other half is. Grandfather explains to Deanne the other half is kept by his friend Miss Rose, who lives in America. One day, a mysterious package arrives for Grandfather, and it's the other half of the staff. Deanne fits the pieces together and soon becomes possessed of great fortune. But his good luck has terrible consequences as the people around him begin to suffer torturous nightmares and terrible deaths. As Deanne learns to control and direct his fortune, he slowly introduces the fairies who do his bidding. When Lily shows up in Grandfather's shop, she is Miss Rose's granddaughter, and she's come to collect the other half of the Eden Log. Deanne refuses to give up his power and directs the fairies to destroy Lily. But Lily's got a secret power of her own, and she won't go down without a fight.
Okay, spoiler alert.
So we've got a mixing of East and West there.
I know. It's very interesting. And who's making that movie?
It's someone you haven't heard of before, and of course, because I don't remember the name.
Oh, okay.
I can't tell you who it is.
Now, I'm really excited about this next movie on my list. It's a little movie called District 9. In this prequel to District 13, the story moves into the distant past, and the setting to London, where a madman named Spring-Heeled Jack is terrorizing the rooftops of the cramped and congested East End. With the famously rotund bobbies unable to catch up with him, Scotland Yard is forced to recruit Paris's most agile lawman, Henri de Saint-Germain, to chase him down, inventing the sport of parkour at the same time.
Wow.
I know. Because the thing is...
I haven't seen District 13.
Oh, you haven't?
So I should probably watch that one before I... No, so I should see that one before I go out and see District 9.
Well, because it's a prequel set some 400 years earlier... I don't think it's going to be too much of a problem, but I'm so excited about a parkour film set in the slums of, like, you know,
London.
17th and 18th century London, because the streets there before the fire were famously, like, 6 feet apart. So there's no point in that city that you, like, can't climb up a wall and jump on top of a building. And, like, you could just run up a wall going from building to building back then. Seeing them doing that kind of stunts... back in the 18th century is going to be fantastic.
That'll be amazing.
I know.
I know. And I love really good physical stunts like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure, I don't know much about the movie, but it's not going to be a lot of wire work. Obviously, whenever you're doing parkour scenes, it's got to be a little wire work. So, you know, everyone doesn't die. But beyond that, I think it's going to be pretty practical.
Yeah. No, it sounds good. Also, out is The Perfect Getaway. And David Tui, the man who created Riddick and made Julian Sands famous, brings us a perfect getaway. Jacqueline is on the lam, wanted for a grisly triple homicide. When her car breaks down in rural West Virginia, that's hard to say, she's forced to steal one from a local family of cannibal inbreds. Now on the run from both the police and the Wallace clan, Jacqueline has to make it all the way to Mexico before the organs she's transporting are no longer good for transplant. While en route, she runs amok of a heavily armed Mormon missionary, a drug-dealing shapeshifter, and the KKK. Note, Vin Diesel is not in this movie.
Oh! Okay, I'm going to ask you a question there. Did she harvest organs from the three people she killed?
That's what it sounds like.
Because I'm not sure whether I can root for a character who's killing people and stealing their organs.
Well, Jacqueline she's really lovable, though.
Oh, okay.
She's quirky, and she's funny, and quick-witted, and you can't help but like her.
Like a Lori Petty character from the early 90s.
Exactly.
You know what? Maybe it'll win me over. I'm thinking it's more of a video kind of movie.
Give it a chance. keep an open mind.
Well, I'm always willing to do that. I have two now. One of them is very short, so I'll just do two quickly. Final Destination 4 in 3D. The plot is that after four movies, they arrive.
No spoiler, though. You're not going to tell me where they're going?
No, no, no. Well, they're going to their final destination.
Oh, they finally get
it. It's right there in the title.
In 3D, no less.
Oh, I'm excited. Next up is a little movie called Sorority Row. When Larry Flint opens a hustler theme park, the most popular attraction quickly becomes the houses on Sorority Row, where scantily clad coeds frolic about all hours of the day and night. When Alice Monroe gets a job running a saltwater taffy concession at the theme park, she thinks it's her big chance to turn her life around. But temptation is all about her. Will she make it as a world-class taffy chef? Or be seduced by the siren's call of all-girl action? Find out this summer in Larry Flint's The House on Sorority Row.
That's not a horror movie.
I didn't say it was a horror movie. You said to preview the House of the Sorority Row. There's two of them, the horror movie and the pornographic version of the horror movie. I elected to
and
review
you
the
went
second.
For the version. Oh, see, I've seen the original, and I was looking forward to hearing what the remake had to offer, but...
Well, this is the pornographic version of the remake, so it has to offer a lot of all-girl action.
Moving right along.
Please do.
We come to The Box. Interesting follow on from the porno version of Sorority.
What is wrong with you?
A lot.
How could you think that was
appropriate? Based on a Twilight Zone episode. Based on a Twilight Zone episode. This movie was originally rated R, but was recut for a PG-13 audience. Jack and Alice are antiquing in the quaint village of Comstock-upon-Lough. In one particular shop, the aged antiquarian presents them with a Victorian-era jewelry box. Alice immediately falls in love with it, as her great-aunt had one just like it but was lost in a fire. A few days later, Alice opens up the box and finds an engagement ring inside. She accepts Jack's proposal, and just when they think life can't get any better, a man shows up at the door with a briefcase full of money. Jack's mother presents Alice with a family heirloom, a string of pearls, which she places in her new jewelry box. Sometime later, the same man shows up at the door again, wearing the same briefcase full of cash. As Alice and Jack begin their married life, Alice reveals that she's pregnant. Jack presents her with a locket, which she places in the box, and a few days later, she miscarries. As Alex recuperates from the loss of her baby, the cash man arrives, and Alice begins to wonder if there's a connection between her miscarriage and the box. I don't know.
That
sounds like it could have been really good, but that PG-13 is sort of is looming over my head.
Yeah, there's pretty much no way that can be successful. Also, it sounds oddly depressing.
Yeah.
It's hard to get really back from a miscarriage in a movie. Just as a rule. Kind of stops the conversation dead in film. Oh, except when it neatly ties up plot loose ends, as it did in the movie Crossroads.
See, now you're viewing Crossroads for me.
Actually, I think it was the movie Crossroads.
But which one?
That ruined Crossroads for everyone. And as Merman just pointed out, there are three movies named Crossroads. So you don't know which one I mean. Is it the one about Britney Spears with the unwed mother? Or the one about Ralph Macchio selling his soul to the devil? Who knows? Okay.
Well, everybody knows you're talking about Britney Spears.
Well, I'm not confirming or denying that. Next up is G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. When General Infantryman Joe Pennywither returned from Iraq, he found his hometown in shambles. Businesses closed, schools burned down, churches turned into brothels. He quickly gets to the bottom of the situation. It seems everyone in town has fallen under the sway of a charismatic cult leader who belongs to an extreme brand of Christianity, one that makes you prove your faith by handling snakes. If Joe's ever going to find justice, he'll have to go undercover, right into the serpent's den.
Do serpents have dens?
They do have dens. Merman and I had a long discussion about whether they had dens, lairs, or nests. And although we were right in front of the internet the entire time, we didn't look it up. And I'm standing by den.
We went with den. Okay.
Oh, also, that movie cost $280 million to make.
Wow.
Yes. It's a record for a
special
small town redneck revenge movie.
Looking forward to it. I like G.I. Joe. Up next, we have Drag Me to Hell.
Ooh.
Sam Raimi returns to horror with this low-budget indie film. Starring Ted Raimi, Drag Me to Hell is the story of Alan Stewart Morgan, a man who believes he's cursed with collecting souls for the devil. Alan roams across the Midwestern U.S., extracting souls with a variety of ill-conceived homemade tools, including a baseball bat with a nail in it. When Alan runs across another soul collector, he thinks his cursed existence is at an end, but the collector refuses to extract Alan's soul. Alan stalks the man across four states, dutifully collecting souls along the way. When they arrive in Missouri, Alan follows the man to an abandoned house where he witnesses a satanic rite. Too late does Alan realize his fellow soul collector is the devil himself. The devil makes short, nasty work of the Satanist and catches Alan watching him. At last, the devil agrees to take Alan's soul, but now Alan's not so sure he wants to let it go.
Ooh. You know, after years and years of god-awful Spider-Man movies, I am really happy he's back in horror.
Me too.
That just sounds fantastic. And I'm sad that he doesn't really have a budget to work with, but when you cast Ted Raimi as the lead in your movie, you're just not going to have any resources.
I was going to say, even if it is low budget, you've got Ted Raimi in the lead, so it's not going to make a difference.
No, no, that's true.
He did his best work without any money, so, you know, there's nothing to complain about.
Although, to be fair, at that point, he was not in the union, so he was able to make his best work with no money. Now they kind of force you to spend money. It's really ridiculous. But nonetheless, that's an opening day kind of movie for me. I am there.
Yes, definitely.
A film I'm a little less excited about is the next one, Saw 6. When Billy was a little boy, he loved astronomy, gazing into the night sky with his homemade telescope. All that end of the night, he saw 6 lights in the sky, moving at incredible speeds, turning at impossible angles. From that moment forth, he just dedicated his life to uncovering the mysteries of flying saucers. But little did he know how terrifying the answers to his questions would be. It seems that the saucers' origins were far closer to home than Billy ever imagined. That's right. They're actually made by mole men who live under the Earth's surface. And Billy's parents are mole man scouts. Actually, maybe I shouldn't have given away the twist ending there, actually.
No. But that really was unexpected.
It's quite a twist.
And really nothing to do with Saw at all. Yeah,
no.
I thought, see, this is weird. It really threw me, because I thought Saw 6 would just be, you know, the next installment in the Jigsaw franchise.
It's just a coincidence that the titles are so similar.
Wow.
I know.
Surprising.
You'd think that a movie called Saw 6 would be the sequel to Saw 5, but it's an unrelated movie. It's going to be one of those things where there's two Saw 6s this year, and, you know, one of them is going to have a little Roman numeral 1 beside its name, and the other one will have a Roman numeral 2 on the old web internet.
Right, or maybe like a subscript.
Yeah, Saw okay.
Saw 6A, Saw 6B.
You know what? Like one of them might get pushed to 2010, and we won't have this problem.
Okay. Yeah, that would solve a lot of problems. We have got another one here. They Came From Upstairs. Billed as a children's movie, They Came From Upstairs belongs to the same genre as Legend and Labyrinth, meaning it will psychologically scar anyone under 12. When the Freemans move into the old Crenshaw place, the twins Jamie and Julie have a hard time making friends, and they spend their days exploring their new home. In the attic, they find an old journal hidden behind a loose board in the wall. Then one day they meet Oscar, the shut-in kid who lives next door with his overbearing mother. After sneaking Oscar out of the house, the twins force him to tell them about old man Crenshaw. Oscar reveals that Crenshaw was rumored to have stolen babies and then hid them in his attic where he performed tests on them. The kids return to the old journal and discover within its pages the details of Crenshaw's experiments. After holding a seance to contact the lost souls of the test subjects, Jamie, Julie, and Oscar find themselves haunted by the ghosts of Crenshaw's victims. The only way to defeat the evil dead ghost babies is to finish the last experiment.
Oh my god, they're going to have to kill a kid?
Well, I don't know. Maybe not.
It kind of sounds like it, because, yee, are you sure that's a children's movie?
It says.
My god. Ugh. I gotta say.
It kind of goes what I was saying earlier, when, you know, they used to make really horrifying children's movies.
Yeah,
and
well.
And they don't anymore. This might turn to form.
Okay, it's just seems excessive a little. I mean, this one I've got is, I think, a little better. It's a little movie called The Stepfather. In this hilarious comic retelling of the classic tale, two kids' lives are turned upside down when their mother marries a wacky ball of energy played by Robin Williams. As they gradually grow to suspect that his jibes, accents, costumes, and games conceal a desire to murder them all, the kids are left with only one solution: kill him before he gets them. A laugh riot fit for the whole family.
Robin Williams, eh?
Robin Williams starring in The New Stepfather, yes.
Okay, haven't seen or heard from him in a while. So.
Exactly. I think he needs the money. Let's just say RV was not the blockbuster that everyone had expected it to be.
Oh, that's too bad.
That's right. Everyone had expected RV to be a blockbuster.
Oh, I've got one more.
Oh, hit me.
And this one I've been looking forward to. Where the Wild Things Are.
Ooh, based on the book, I assume.
Based on your favorite kid's book.
Of course.
Meaning your favorite from when you were a kid and not the book belonging to your
favorite. Oh, not the favorite, not the book of my favorite kid.
Exactly.
Ah, yeah. Now I understand.
One night, Max dresses up in his wolf costume and runs around the house terrorizing his little sister and the family dog. As punishment, he's sent to his room with ebony dinner. Bored, he begins rearranging his furniture, and in so doing manages to create a four-dimensional Euclidean space. Max crosses the threshold and finds himself in a dark forest inhabited by very large and very hungry monsters. Max is swallowed whole by what looks kind of like a chicken, but he climbs back up the chicken's throat. Having survived the chicken monster, Max is crowned King of the Wild Things, and he leads them on military campaigns against the monsters in neighboring lands. As the Wild Things slowly take over their world, Max plots to invade his home and feed his enemies to his monster army.
They've made some changes.
Well, it's a short book, and you know, you gotta fill in for time.
And yeah, they filled in all right. That you can always trace that Spike Jones for something interesting. I'll give you that.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's my very favorite book. I'm looking forward to this.
I gotta say, it's actually nice that it dovetails with my final pick, because it's about a boy who dresses as a wolf, and my final movie is The Wolfman.
Oh, all right.
I know. A country torn apart by racial, economic, and generational strife. Tension reaching the boiling point. Only one man could bring everyone together. Through the Power of Rock! A stunning new biopic detailing the life of Wolfman Jack, a man so cool that to this day, no one knows what race he was. Although a quick search of the Internet Movie Database or Wikipedia would probably answer that question.
Did he really dress as a wolf?
No, he's just a DJ.
Oh, I got confused.
Well, he was the Wolfman, Wolfman Jack. It's like,
no,
you've never,
yeah, I know.
Have you never seen American Graffiti?
No.
Oh, Okay, well, that would be the next thing that you have to see. My hopefully...
I'll add it to the list.
Horribly embarrassed person. It's George Lucas's only good movie as a director.
Oh, that's not true.
What other good directing job did he ever do?
Did he direct the first Star Wars movie?
He did, but it is not a good job.
There you go. Yes, it's a... Yes.
It's a wonderful movie, but it's a terribly directed movie.
Not having this conversation.
Okay. Merman wants to know if he directed Howard the Duck, so I'm going to look that up. I don't think he directed it.
That's not a good movie.
Oh my god, yeah, now you've basically made an enemy for life, because it is actually the Merman's favorite film. It's about a duck who battles H.P. Lovecraft monsters from beyond time and space.
Yeah, but I've got this problem with anthropomorphized robots. And Howard the Duck, though he's not a robot, fits into that category.
I understand now. It was written and directed by Willard Hyuk, a longtime collaborator of George Lucas, who wrote such wonderful films as American Graffiti and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Oh, no, wait. I hated Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Forget that. I don't like Willard Hyuk anymore.
That's the scariest one.
It is the scariest one, but it suffered from not being written by Lawrence Kasdan. So that's it for the AVOD this week. We hope we've gotten you excited about some of the upcoming genre films this year, be they biopic or pornography. And be sure to tune in next week when the AVOD presents our first ever one-topic showcase, a retrospective on the series Friday the 13th.
Yes, it's the AVOD Jasonorama.
That's right, premiering on Friday, February 13th at 1 a.m., giving you a full, what time do theaters open? Like 10 a.m.? 9 hours to listen to it before you go and see the new Friday the 13th movie. We're going to give you everything you need to know about Friday the 13th if you've never seen it before. And if you have seen it before, take a beautiful walk down memory lane with us as we talk about the greatest series of horror films of all time.
Really? The greatest ever?
This is a conversation we can have next week.
Okay. All right. Good night, everybody.
As always, you can check out our blogs at vargelon.blogspot.com.
Zombot.blogspot.com. And, of course, the AVOD blog, theavod.blogspot.com.
If you have any questions, comments, or just want to tell us how wrong we are, please send all mail to theavod@gmail.com. Until next week, I'm Count Vargelon.
And I am the Dive Mistress.
Wishing you a happy evening.